The following is a Reels Channel and Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised. A successful and handsome young businessman is found brutally murdered in his shower, shot and stabbed with a viciousness investigators had never seen before.
The way the victim had been attacked, I mean, it was awful.
The unlikely suspect, a pretty young ex-girlfriend who took romantic obsession to a whole new level.
Who's Lisa?
She's just a friend, relax.
Tell me you love me, Travis.
Is this from that psycho girl, Jody?
You use me? You disrespect me?
I've been honest with you from the beginning.
How many are there, Travis?
A woman whose attraction knew no bounds.
She would just do anything she could to try and get Travis to love her.
The texts, the emails, the phone calls. Jody was addicted to everything about Travis.
You're never going to be a part of my life.
And whose brutal crime shocked an entire nation.
Jody Arias was a nobody, and all of a sudden she became famous.
Every day, media, media, media.
And she loved it.
Meet Jody Arias. Just another broken heart until murder made her famous. Few crimes in recent memory have captured the media spotlight like the Jody Arias case. Its tawdry elements of jealousy, obsession, sexual deviance, and violent death unfold like a best-selling crime novel. But the brutal murder of Travis Alexander is no fiction, as disturbing photos taken by the murderess herself attest. What drove a pretty young woman with her whole life ahead of her to commit the unspeakable?
Senior crime reporter Steve Helling.
Jody Arias came from a typical, normal, middle-class family from Yreka, California.
Starting at an early age, however, Jody demonstrated a rebellious streak.
Jody, what are you doing?
Nothing.
What are you hiding? What is that? Is that a marijuana plant?
Maybe.
Belle, come in here.
What's going on?
This is a marijuana plant.
Oh, well, isn't that just nice? Well, we'll see what the police have to say about that.
Daddy, what are you doing?
I'm teaching you a lesson.
Daddy, no!
Jody Arias was in eighth grade when she was caught growing marijuana, and her parents actually turned her into the police. There was a resentment there that she never got over.
As a teenager, Jody works as a waitress in her family's restaurant.
Author Brian Skoloff.
Jody liked to portray herself as somebody who had a very hard upbringing, was physically and emotionally abused by her parents, things that were really never proven at trial.
Near the end of her junior year, Jody is grounded until she turns 18 for skipping class.
She drops out of school. She moves in with a guy who's much older than her and says that she's in love.
Jody was sort of a wandering person trying to find her way in life.
This relationship did not work out, and Jody decided she wanted more out of her life than just being a waitress.
Jody finally catches the break she is looking for when she stumbles upon a multi-level marketing organization.
She had found out about this company, Prepaid Legal, through a friend of hers and decided it sounded like an interesting thing.
So she dyes her hair blonde, packs her bags, loads her car, and drives out to Palm Springs to start a new life.
At a Prepaid Legal conference in Las Vegas, Jody will meet a man named Travis Alexander, a successful young salesman, popular motivational speaker, and devout Mormon.
But every successful person in life has one thing in common. They don't listen to dream killers, and neither should you.
Travis is a person who had a very rough life himself. I mean, both his parents were drug addicts. Him and his siblings were raised by his grandmother, actually. And they struggled to get by. They did not have much money.
He was a good guy.
Friend of Travis Alexander, Daniel Freeman.
We went on trips together. We talked a lot about philosophy and personal development and how to be a better person.
He was very gregarious, very social, very easy to get along with other people. And that attracted a lot of friends and a lot of women.
Autumn 2006. As Jody waits for a friend at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino, she and Travis Alexander share a chance encounter. Travis spots the attractive young blonde and makes a fateful introduction.
Hi, I'm Travis Alexander.
Jody Arias.
Travis invites her to an executive banquet that evening.
Hey guys, I want to introduce you to somebody. This is Jody Arias.
Hi, Jody. Nice to meet you. You're so pretty.
Nice to
meet you
too.
Jody, nice to meet you. Hey, be careful with this guy.
What are you saying? What is this?
For once in her life, Jody Arias is dining with upscale people rather than being their servers. It was intoxicating and exciting for her.
Hi, Jody. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Bells went off, or whatever you want to call it.
Jury foreman William Zervakos
invited her into his world. Changed the trajectory of her life.
Oh, well, let me give you my cell, just in case you ever want to give me a call.
Okay.
And the two apparently hit it off. She really fell for him. He seemed to have fallen for her.
Don't lose that now.
Have a good night.
You too.
Jody lived in Palm Springs. Travis lived in Mesa. It was a four-hour drive, but they still managed to make romance blossom.
Yeah, I can cook. A little.
But Jody isn't a Mormon, so Travis encourages her to read and learn about his church.
She talked about the Book of Mormon, and she talked about, you know, wanting to be married in the temple or wanting to live this life, and that she saw it was a very good thing.
After more than a month of phone calls, Travis and Jody meet up in the town of Ehrenberg, Arizona, halfway between Phoenix and Palm Springs. They check into a motel.
So the relationship took off from there, and it became pretty hot and steamy.
It was a very, very physical relationship. There wasn't a lot of warmth and tenderness, so I would have to say that it was driven by sex.
In his public life, Travis was a devout Mormon. In the Mormon faith, they don't believe in sex before marriage, and so Travis had this sort of dual persona, one that he presented publicly as a devout Mormon, you know, seeking that perfect Mormon wife, and another that he kept more private, where he sought out women.
You know, oral sex is okay, anal sex is okay, but we're not going to consummate sexual intercourse, so, you know, we're all good.
You know, Travis, he's a man like anybody. You know, we all have weaknesses, and his happened to be sex.
As Travis drives back to Mesa, Jody calls and leaves a message.
Anyway, give me a call whenever. I miss you already. I know, it's crazy, but anyways, talk to you later. Bye.
For Jody, this was the guy. This was the one for her. And she saw herself walking down the aisle with him someday. Travis couldn't see Jody as wife material, but he sure liked having sex with her.
Jody calls again the next day, numerous times, leaving more messages.
Call me when you can. I'd love to hear from you. Okay, bye.
It is clear to Travis that Jody is more serious about the relationship than he is. Excessive phone calls and texts concern him.
Jody, what are you doing here?
Oh, I was just in the area. Thought I'd say hey.
Yeah, right.
Can I come in?
Come in.
As far as obsession goes, we just saw somebody who seemed to truly love somebody. And was waiting to see if they would choose back the same thing or if they were going to move on, so she could too.
Within months, Jody makes up her mind to join the Mormon church.
Decided she wanted to be baptized and join the church, and then she asked Travis to do it, and he was honored to do it. You know, I mean, he'd been a missionary too. That's always a cool experience to have someone say, we want to embrace the faith that you love too. And, you know, you always wonder, though, looking back now, was it sincere?
Unbeknownst to Jody, Travis was seeing other women on the side. Jody kind of thought that she was the one and was really pushing to be the one.
There was a lot of emotional distress on her part. Not a lot of self-esteem there.
Who's Lisa?
Hey, give me that.
Who is she, Travis?
She's just a friend. Relax.
Don't tell me to relax. That's condescending.
Jody.
I'm not just your booty call, am I?
No.
I want us to be exclusive, Travis. I don't want to share you with anybody. That's not too much to ask, is it? For all I've given you.
No. It's not.
In Travis's social environment, Jody begins to feel like an outsider. Travis even avoids introducing her as his girlfriend.
I mean, in a way, she's perfect. And all she wants to do is please me. And she knows how to be discreet, you know? Yeah.
Everything we saw showed that she wanted, you know, she was pretty much ready to marry him.
The sex was great. The sex was what he wanted. But walking down the aisle, no, that was never going to happen.
I think he was a typical guy. I'm not saying he was a horrible person by any stretch of the imagination. He was just a typical guy, young man, that I don't think had learned commitment.
I've been completely honest with you.
You use me? You disrespect me?
But Travis's lack of commitment is something Jody seems unwilling to accept.
You use me just as much as I use you.
And it will quickly lead him into a nightmare from which there is no escape. Summer 2007. Young businessman Travis Alexander finds himself in a dangerous relationship with an obsessed Jody Arias and decides to end it.
Fine. No, I understand. Well, let's take a little break.
My family and I, we told her kind of the same thing. Well, you know, it'll either work out or it won't. And if it doesn't, you just move on.
It was clear Travis was never in love with her, but he got what he wanted out of the relationship, which was pretty kinky sex anytime he wanted it, anywhere, and Jody fulfilled those desires for him.
In a desperate attempt to preserve their relationship, Jody packs up and moves to Travis's hometown, Mesa, Arizona.
Travis's family and friends say he wanted nothing to do with that, but Jody says he wanted her to be closer to him.
Jody will do anything to stay close to Travis. She volunteers to clean his house, and he agrees to pay her.
They were broken up, and she was doing all these creepy things, but he was still having sex with her.
Travis begins dating a young Mormon woman named Lisa Andrews.
He was seeking out the perfect wife, somebody who was more fit the morals that he presented publicly than in his private life.
Jody finds out about the relationship.
Travis liked Lisa, and Lisa liked Travis, but then she got this letter.
Travis, look at this email. Is this from that psycho girl, Jody?
What? An email to you?
Listen to this. You are a shameful whore. You are wasting your time. You are filthy, and you need to repent. Your future and your salvation rests on your choices and actions.
What the hell?
This girl is insane.
Everyone knew it came from Jody, and it was one of the first steps among many steps that opened people's eyes and said, there's something wrong with this woman.
Who's that?
What the?
Oh my gosh. She slashed your tires?
I'm so sick of these games!
Jody was addicted to Travis, and nothing was going to sway her from that.
Jody even sneaks into his house through a pet door by jumping a backyard fence.
It's obvious that she is taking this to another level entirely.
A disturbing entry in Jody's diary, dated August 2nd, 2007, speaks to her state of mind.
I love him. I could possibly love him not, though I wish I could. Turn it off like a light switch. Duct tape it down so it can't be turned back on. Or better yet, just cut the circuit. Cut off at its life source. Make it dead within seconds. Lifeless.
In late March of 2008, Jody Arias leaves Mesa, Arizona, and moves back to Northern California to live with her grandparents. It's an attempt to leave Travis Alexander, the man she has been obsessed with for the past year and a half. But she will find letting go of Travis to be impossible.
So Travis finally meets this woman named Mimi at his church. She's a good Mormon girl, she's marriage material, and they start dating.
Mimi Hall had always been an interest of his. He wanted something more romantic with her. She didn't seem to want anything romantic with him at the time. They were planning to go to Cancun together, stay in separate rooms. Jody found out about it and obviously wasn't too pleased. He was heading off to Mexico with another woman. And of course, prosecutors think this was the final straw that set her off.
The trip to Cancun with Mimi Hall is set for June 10th. But amazingly, Travis continues long-distance sexual conversations with Jody.
Travis was no angel in the relationship. Records have shown transcriptions of their phone calls and text messages that Travis did not treat her well. He obviously didn't. He spoke down to her. He hid her from friends and family. Jody couldn't see that she was being used for sex. She would just do anything she could to try and get Travis to love her and make her be the one. And it was just never going to happen.
1 month before Travis's death, Jody records one of their phone sex conversations. It would later be played back at her trial.
The way you know, Jody, it sounds like you're a 12-year-old girl having her first orgasm.
It sounds like what?
12-year-old girl having her first orgasm.
Jody secretly records these conversations, and now she's got blackmail material. And she sends him pamphlets in the mail about pedophilia. When Travis got those pamphlets, he saw red. And he called Jody every name in the book. Evil, sociopath, whore.
You are the worst thing that has ever happened to me. You are a sociopath. A demented laughing stock. Who freaking cares about you? You are worthless. You are pure evil. I hate you.
It was a toxic relationship, and so it just kept escalating. And it was almost like, can you top this? I'm going to send you things about pedophilia. Well, I'm going to call you a whore. And where is it going to end? It's not going to end anywhere good.
Jody's attempt to control the relationship backfires. Travis is now more resentful of her than ever. One week before Travis is murdered, a burglary is reported at Jody's grandparents' home. One of the items missing is a .25 caliber handgun. Police will later speculate that Jody staged the burglary in order to secure a weapon with which to kill Travis.
The gun was reported missing from Jody's grandparents' home in Northern California, where Jody was about a week before the killing.
Jody dyes her blonde hair back to brown. On June 2nd, she rents a car in Redding, California, 100 miles from her home. She removes the front license plate, turns the rear one upside down to obscure its readability, fills 3 5-gallon gas containers to avoid stopping for fuel, and switches off her cell phone. All in an attempt, say investigators, to make her trip to Mesa, Arizona, untraceable. The journey takes nearly 15 hours, but it's one that Jody has carefully planned. She arrives at Travis's home at 4:30 a.m., enters a code into a security keypad, and gains access quietly through the garage.
That's the thing about Jodi Arias. She did some very creepy things that anybody else would have said, okay, I think this relationship is over. She drove through the dead of night to stand in his house without him knowing.
Hello, Travis.
What the hell? What are you doing here?
And he thought that was okay. He let her stay. Rather than setting up any sort of boundaries that you've crossed the line this time, Jodi, get out of my house.
The day of the murder, they were spending a lot of time in bed. They did a lot of crazy things.
They had sex and they took naked pictures of each other.
Then in a 2-minute period of time, he was dead.
Where are you going?
I need a shower.
Romantic obsession is about to lead to a human slaughter straight out of the movie Psycho.
Murder Made Me Famous. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store, but did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
Hi, everybody. This is Susie Orman, and soon we'll be launching my new podcast, Women and Money. Don't you miss it. On the show, besides having a lot of fun, we're going to answer financial questions from listeners, and maybe, just maybe, we'll even put you on so we can have a chat. Wouldn't you just love to talk to me? So be sure to check out Women and Money on Apple Podcasts, podcast1.com, and the new Podcast One app.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised. June 4th, 2008. After a toxic year-and-a-half relationship, Jodi Arias enters ex-boyfriend Travis Alexander's bathroom armed with a knife.
What are you doing now?
I want you to model for me.
Model for you?
Come on, baby. Show me that hot body.
Just can't get enough, huh?
Show me your face. Sit down.
What?
Sit down in the shower.
Why?
Because it's sexy. I want a picture. Close your eyes like you're fantasizing about me. Are you thinking about me, Travis?
Yes.
Are you thinking about me?
Yes.
Good.
Jodi's first knife strike may have incapacitated Travis because he was bigger than her, he was stronger than her, he could have overpowered her if he wasn't injured in such a mortal way.
Ah! Oh!
He stumbles out of the shower and over to the mirror.
Oh.
What is he doing?
You can almost picture him just bleeding out, just standing in front of the mirror looking at himself with Jody behind him, coming at him with a knife. And proceeded to just lash him and gash him up to 30 times, and then slit his neck from ear to ear, almost deep enough to decapitate him.
As brutal as it was, and as unthinkable as it wasn't over yet.
Travis? Sweetie, are you okay? Travis?
And she got the gun and just shot him in the head as just one final salvo of rage. After this brutal attack happened, Jody then dragged his body, his lifeless body, back into the shower and just left him in the shower.
This was not a clean crime scene. Jody left a bloody palm print on the wall with both her and Travis's DNA in it. To have the victim and the killer's blood mixed is so damning that there's no getting past that.
Jody tosses bloody sheets and clothing into the wash machine, along with the camera.
Why she didn't take the camera with her is extremely puzzling. Yeah, she took the gun with her. She took other things with her. Why she left behind photographic evidence that she was there is inexplainable.
You know, pretty pathetic job at trying to clean up. The forensic evidence all over the place. She was hosed any way you look at it. And the camera was just kind of the here you go, on a silver platter kind of thing. Doesn't make any sense.
But obviously, she wasn't aware in this day and age. We have forensic experts who can restore these sorts of things and reclaim those photos, even despite the fact that they were run through a wash cycle.
Still planning her alibi, Jody drives to Utah to visit a former coworker. On the way, a police officer pulls her over.
Good evening, miss.
Hello, officer.
Do you know why I stopped you?
No, sir.
Your rear license plate is upside down.
Somebody must have just been playing a prank on me or something.
What happened to your hands?
They're fine. I was just working in the garden earlier and got a little carried away.
Well, I'd like you to pull into the next service station and get that rear plate turned around, okay?
Sure.
Just a warning this time.
Thank you.
Good night.
Two days later, she returns the rental car. She has put nearly 3,000 miles on it. Over the next several days, Travis's friend Mimi Hall tries unsuccessfully to reach him.
Travis's friends thought that he had already gone to Mexico, but Mimi knew that couldn't be the case because she was supposed to go with him.
At 10 o'clock at night on June 9th, Mimi and a few of Travis's friends enter the house. Upstairs, the body of Travis Alexander is discovered behind a locked bedroom door.
They found his body. It was all cut up and mutilated. The roommate who found it he pretty much almost vomited from the smell in the room from Travis's body decaying in there.
A friend of ours is dead in his bedroom. We hadn't heard from him for a while. We think he's dead.
The initial 911 call came in from friends, and they were obviously frantic.
Has he been threatened by anyone recently?
Yes, he has. Okay. He has an ex-girlfriend that's been bothering him, and
following him and slashing tires and things like that.
And do you know the ex-girlfriend's name?
Her name is Jody.
Jody is instantly associated with this death.
So boom, right then and there, the red flag goes up. Who's this woman, Jody?
Family and friends learn that Travis is dead.
One of my friends called, who was at Travis's house, and was crying on the phone and said, "Dan, you won't believe what happened. Like, Travis is gone." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? He's gone. Like, where'd he go? Like, he's dead." And I'm like, "What?" It was shocking when I found out that he'd been killed.
As one of Jody's closest friends in Arizona, Daniel decides he must be the one to break the news to her.
When I called Jody, one, I dreaded to do it. I didn't know she already knew that he was dead, for one, but to me, I was going to call someone who I knew loved him and wanted to marry him, and she picked up and was like, "Hello?" And, you know, just normal, didn't sound off or expecting anything, just, "Oh, hey, what's going on?" And I couldn't speak for a minute. And she's like, "Dan, are you there?" I said, "Jody, Travis is gone." And she said, "What?" I said, "He's dead, Jody. Travis is gone. They found him today. Like, he was killed." And she was quiet for a minute and kind of breathing heavy, and sounded to me someone very much in distress, having just learned this, which was understandable. I wasn't going to say anything. And so I just listened for probably 2 or 3 minutes while she cried. And I said, "Jody, do you need anything? Is there anything that I can do, you know, to help? Or are you okay?" And she said, "No, I'm not okay, but there's not anything you can do to help."
At a memorial service for Travis, family and friends grieve. No one could have expected what happened next.
I didn't hear you breathe.
At a memorial service for 30-year-old Travis Alexander, who was brutally murdered in his bathroom, the one person police, family, and friends suspect might be the assailant makes a surprise appearance.
"Hi, I'm Jody Arias."
Jody comes to the memorial service, introduces herself to Mimi, and everybody is stunned that she would do that.
You know, you could hear the murmurs and the whispers running through the crowd, and one of his sisters had said, you know, had pulled me aside and just said, "How can you bring her here?" As people would make accusations, "Well, it was probably Jody who did it." And I'm like, you guys don't even know her. Like, just because she's the ex doesn't mean she did it.
10 days after the discovery of the murder, Mesa, Arizona detectives travel to Northern California. They meet their number one suspect, Jody Arias. Interrogation video shows Jody acting strangely when police are not in the room.
Actual audio recording.
"I didn't hear you breathe. I wonder how am I still here?"
She's singing, she's standing on her head, she's not doing what you would think someone would do in police custody. And then they sit down and they say to her, "We found the digital camera. It has pictures of you and Travis on the day of his murder."
"I know you took pictures of him in the shower just before he died."
"I don't think he would allow that."
"And the camera actually took a couple of photos by accident during the time he was being killed."
"Really?"
One of the photos accidentally snapped by the camera appears to show Travis's bloody body being dragged by Jody. With the photos and other evidence, Jody is indicted on July 9th and charged with first-degree murder. 6 days later, Jody is arrested at her grandparents' house. Outspoken and controversial Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio allows generous media access to Jody.
Her jailer was an interesting character, Joe Arpaio, who is no stranger to the media.
It had sex, vicious, violent murder.
Former county sheriff Joe Arpaio.
So people like to look at this type of thing.
And he let the media come in and interview her anytime they wanted to. And Jody was more than happy to talk.
Sorry, don't roll the tape yet.
Jody Arias was a nobody, and all of a sudden she became famous.
Jody loved the spotlight. She wanted to be a star. This was her time to shine.
The evidence is very compelling, but none of it proves that I committed a murder.
If the media didn't care, you think anybody else would care? You think that's the first time somebody killed a boyfriend or husband or something? We got a whole bunch of murderers in there. But once that media gets it, boy, then everybody gets involved.
Kinky sex and murder really just captured the public's attention.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining.
I had inmate Idol. She actually won the singing contest while she was in jail. So she bragged about that.
Then Jody surprises everyone when, in an interview, she admits that she was with Travis when he died.
Jody said that actually she was there, but she didn't do the killing. Two masked intruders just somehow found their way into this house, killed Travis, and left without leaving a trace of DNA or any evidence.
Yeah. I was screaming, and I was by the bathtub. I remember putting my hand on his back because he was on his all four of his knees. He was like on his knees like this, doing something like this or something like, I don't know. And I was like, are you okay? What's going on? He's like, go get help. And I said, okay. And I turned around. There were two people there. One was a guy and one was a girl.
Over time, her story changes again.
And this time she was saying that, yes, she killed Travis Alexander, but it was in self-defense because she felt threatened by him. And that changed the case completely. Instead of being a whodunit, it was why did she do it?
The trial begins in late 2012. It lasts 5 months, and the critical evidence is the .25 caliber handgun. Jurors believe the gun used to kill Travis was the same gun reported stolen from Jody's grandparents' house.
All the particulars of what's going
on. It was a key fact that really proved that Jody not only killed Travis, but planned this out and had premeditated it.
Jody's claims of self-defense were unconvincing to the jury.
As he was lunging at me, the gun went off. I didn't mean to shoot him or anything.
Medical examiner testified that had he been shot before he was stabbed, the gunshot wound to the head likely would have incapacitated him, and there would have been no way he would have been able to fight back, as was shown on the knife marks on his hands.
I had heard that Jody had claimed self-defense and that Travis had attacked her, and to me that sounded very far-fetched. I'm like, Travis has never attacked anybody.
The whole defense strategy throughout the entire trial was to demonize Travis, to make Travis look like he was the perpetrator and Jody was the victim.
Rarely in a murder case did photos exist of the victim immediately before death. This disturbing image of Travis Alexander is believed to have been snapped by Jody seconds before his murder.
The murder scene was tough. It was really tough. The victim, I mean, Travis, and the way, you know, he had been attacked and brutally murdered, I mean, it was awful.
The photographs from the crime scene, I think, were just really hit the jury hard.
If you remove the masks from people, sometimes you're shocked at what you find underneath. Sometimes it's beautiful, and other times it's quite frightening.
Nearly 5 years after the murder of Travis Alexander, the jury enters deliberations. 15 hours later, they return their verdict. But facing a conviction and a possible death sentence, Jody Arias isn't through talking. And what she says will chill the courtroom. May 8th, 2013. As America holds its breath, the jury in the highly publicized Jody Arias trial returns its verdict.
Every day, media, media, media.
The state of Arizona versus Jody Ann Arias, verdict, count one. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn, in the above entitled action, upon our oaths, do find the defendant as to count one, first-degree murder, guilty.
I've said many times that this is a tragedy of epic proportions, and certainly for the Alexander family, but also for her family. The only thing that really had to be decided in two things, was it premeditated, which we all decided that it was, and did it warrant a death penalty?
Now a convicted killer, Jody Arias awaits her sentence. It takes all 12 jurors voting yes to impose the death penalty.
Everybody thought it was a slam dunk. It was going to be really easy. Go in there and just, you know, she admitted it. She did this horrible thing. It was absolutely heinous. You know, put her to death.
State of Arizona versus Jody Ann Arias, sentencing verdict. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn in above entitled action, upon our oaths, unanimously find, having considered all of the facts and circumstances, that the defendant should be sentenced. No unanimous agreement. Signed, foreperson.
The jury fails to reach a unanimous decision on how to sentence Jody.
They deadlocked, and they just couldn't decide on whether to sentence her to life in prison or in debt or death.
Eight jurors voted for death, and four voted against, including William Zervakos.
Here's the story of a couple where one ends up dead and the other, for all intents and purposes, is dead because their life's over. From a human standpoint, I'm not about sympathy. I've been pegged as a sympathizer, as Jody, for I could give a damn about that. There were 27 years of normal life. That was a big mitigating factor.
Jurors also believed that Travis was emotionally abusive.
Do I believe that she was mentally abused or emotionally abused? Absolutely. Physically? It was never proven. But emotionally, from what I heard and what I read and what I saw, yeah, I think so.
On March 5th, 2015, a second jury fails to reach a unanimous decision.
Right at this time, the court is declaring a mistrial. We will certainly accommodate that request.
The sobs come from the Alexander family. They know now that Jody is no longer eligible for the death penalty.
The judge had two options, life without parole or life with a chance of parole after 25 years.
Travis was not only my brother, but we were really close friends. I looked up to him.
Deep down, I knew that she killed my brother, and I couldn't do anything about it.
Jody's mother pleads for mercy for her daughter.
Jody's the firstborn of four children. She didn't come out with instructions, so we did the best we could with what we knew. I guess the one thing we failed to teach her was how to walk away from an abusive relationship.
Jody herself remains defiant.
I do remember the moment when the knife went into Travis's throat and he was conscious. He was still trying to attack me. It was I who was trying to get away, not Travis, and I finally did. I never wanted it to be that way, Judge.
As America awaits Jody's sentence, social media explodes in anticipation and speculation.
It is ordered. The defendant shall be incarcerated in the Department of Corrections for the rest of her natural life with no possibility of parole.
People will say, well, no death penalty. Just let her stay there the rest of her life. That's worse than a death penalty. Some people say that. So they got their wish.
A cartoon in the Arizona Republic newspaper expresses the sentiment of many people who've watched the case unfold at a cost of more than $3 million.
She wanted the publicity. She wanted to have movies made. She wanted all this.
Unless an appeal miraculously sets her free, Jody Arias will die in prison.
The cruel irony of this whole thing is that now that she's been convicted, she can't give any more interviews. We'll never hear from her again. And in many ways, that's a fate worse than death.
Once her friend, Daniel Freeman, looks back through photographs, he discovers one taken at the Grand Canyon that seems to foreshadow what is to come.
It's just interesting to have with the story now. It just makes you pause. Even as I look back at the photos, it's still very surreal. And I see the photos of Jody or the video clips of her in court with her dark hair and glasses. And the girl in court doesn't look like the Jody I knew even. You know, just from her appearance, her hair, the way she takes care of herself. it's hard, but I hope, you know, we can all go on and move forward and not be defined by the fact that Jody killed Travis. He always loved the sculpture of the self-made man. It's one of my favorites, too. A man carving himself out of rock. And, you know, life is hard. And sometimes the harsh reality is you can't control other people's actions. And they affect you. And Jody's choices, nobody had control over those but her. And she made a choice that changed everybody's life.
You look at what happened to Travis and the kind of person he was, and sometimes you think back to your own youth. You never know when it's going to be that one that is a fatal mistake.
That concludes this episode of Murder Made Me Famous. Don't forget to go to Reels.com, that's R-E-E-L-Z.com, for clips, extras, and more. And check out the new season starting Saturday, April 14th on the Reels channel. Don't forget to subscribe on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.